Good morning. I'm Nate Osborne, and I'm married to Kathleen Jones. We moved to Goshen just over a year ago with our daughters, Nora and Lena. And when we each independently said yes to Kara's invitation to be storytellers, we didn't realize we might be speaking on the same topic on the same week. But we also figured that we would likely have much different things to say about self-control and self-compassion. So here's my story. I recently co-led the second hour elective book study where we examined our relationship with our smartphones. I was interested in the phone topic, not at all because I claim to be some sort of expert, but because of my own shortcomings. My own lack of self-control in this area is what really drew me in to more closely examine our relationship with technology. Today, I'd like to share about self-control more broadly and how my experience of it has been impacted by my relationship to the Mennonite community. There's an old joke that asks, how many Mennonites should you bring along on a fishing trip? And as you may know, the answer is two, because if you bring one, they'll drink all your beer, but if you bring two, they won't drink any. So, like many jokes, it's funny because there's truth in it. And the public self-control that we show with each other doesn't always match the way we live privately. I grew up in a Mennonite town and attended Mennonite colleges and churches, and I frequently wished that I were more comfortable just being myself with others. I like to be less cautious socially and less reserved and less concerned with looking good. I'm good at public self-control and making a good impression for others, while in private I often struggle with self-control and discipline, as I suspect many others do. Back in the 90s, just before my senior year at Goshen College, my dad, who was a fairly prominent figure in Mennonite higher education and the author of parenting books, confessed to many years of infidelity and dishonesty with my mom. We were all shocked and had no idea of the double life that he had lived. I had spent much of my childhood trying to gain my dad's approval, doing all the right things, achieving in music and sports and academics, and the sudden crashing down of who I thought he was and subsequently who I thought our family was, made me rethink why I lived the way I did and how I wanted to live going forward. I had spent many years trying to look good, trying to impress, putting on a good show for those around me, achieving, performing, striving for perfection. I was focused on doing rather than being. When I graduated from Goshen College a year later, I no longer had the structure and schedule of school. I wasn't really connected to the church, and my family was not what I thought it was. So I moved to Atlanta, aimed to forge a new life of anonymity in a big city without Mennonite social pressures, where I could relearn how to live for myself. You could say I went on an extended fishing trip by myself with a bunch of non-Mennos for a while. Through much of my time in Atlanta, and in my life currently, I've struggled with wanting to escape, especially when alone, into various forms of mindless activities. Channel surfing, web surfing, endless scrolling through social media, drinking, shopping, and even house projects and cooking. I can completely lose myself in these activities in a way that avoids feeling, thinking, and presence of mind. For many years, when I wasn't with people, I was engaging in extensive mind-numbing escape. I've always struggled with self-control, particularly in this context. In today's social media culture, where we see everyone else's most impressive, best version of themselves on display, it can be especially important to share our personal challenges and struggles, not out of a humble brag, false sense of Mennonite humility, but an authentic addressing of difficult topics, a sharing of our struggles and challenges, which we all have but don't often publicly acknowledge. A focus on external approval, combined with the Mennonite tendency of avoiding conflict and having a tough time talking about difficult issues, can lead to living with a lack of integrity in private when not in the presence of those from whom you are seeking approval. Isolation and shame feed addictive behaviors. The cycle of addiction often starts with a failure of self-control, which leads to shame, isolation, and depression, which are then soothed through more addictive behaviors, which numb the feeling temporarily, until the process starts all over again. This cycle is broken through brutal honesty and self-reflection in the presence of others who show love and compassion that help to dissolve the shame and make self-compassion easier. One good thing that came out of my family's experience is that all the formerly unmentionable topics in my family we now talked about. As a family, we became much more open and honest with each other, which felt incredibly freeing. Living with integrity requires honesty. Honesty within a supportive community leads to self-compassion. A compassionate, supportive community can make self-control easier. Ultimately, like many people, I want to be the same person in public and private. I want to feel good about what I do regardless of who sees me. I want to live an authentic, integrated life of healthy self-control and be part of a supportive community when I struggle. I want to go on fishing trips and drink beer or not drink beer in a mindful way, regardless of who I'm with. After 20 years away, it feels good to have moved back to Goshen, where we are living more simply, more slowly, and are more connected to community. Thank you for welcoming our family.
Hello. To those of you who don't know me, my name is Kathleen Jones, and I'm Nate's spouse and mother to Nora and Lena as well. I too have appreciated the welcome from Assembly during our first year attending here. For a quick bit of background about me, I grew up in the southern United States, mainly in North Florida, in a Methodist household with two parents and an older brother. My extended family all lived in southern Mississippi, so all of my vacations as a child were spent on my grandparents' farm. I moved to Atlanta for college in the mid-1990s and stayed until a little over a year ago, working as a teacher and then an administrator and then a curriculum writer. Nate and I met in 2003, and the rest is history. Learning to have compassion for myself in times of pain and suffering has been a long and windy road, and one that I happen to still be on. I found the Buddhist parable of the second arrow to be especially helpful in hard times, and I will always be grateful to the counselor who introduced the story to me. In this parable, Buddha refers to any painful experience we might have as the first arrow that strikes us. That might be the loss of a loved one, a breakup, loneliness or anxiety, a health or financial struggle, and the list goes on. The second arrow is self-inflicted, and it's our reaction to the pain. It can take the form of us blaming others, lashing out in rage, or indulging in excess to avoid feelings of grief, anger, or embarrassment. For me, however, the second arrow almost always takes the form of self-judgment. Case in point has been my journey with fibromyalgia. When I was 23, I started experiencing chronic tightness and achy muscles throughout my torso, legs, neck, and shoulders. The achiness felt and feels almost flu-like, or like I just ran 10 miles and then didn't stretch afterward. The chronic pain first developed during my first year of teaching when I had a long commute through Atlanta traffic to and from work. Some internet sleuthing brought me to a fibromyalgia checklist, and I felt both relief and fear that I could check off almost every symptom on the list: widespread muscular pain, poor quality sleep, fatigue, stiffness in the morning, and a sense of cognitive fogginess at times, called fibrofog. As it became clear that this set of symptoms was sticking around for a while, I set out to find a cure. And that's when things got ugly. I spent large sums of money for treatments that didn't help. I found exercise that did help, but I didn't follow through with it, and generally decided not to share too much with people about the strange pain I was experiencing. I realized quickly that the term fibromyalgia itself was controversial, with no real consensus in the medical community around what it was, how to treat it, or even whether it was real. The second arrows were flying in my life with great speed. self-judgment around the medical choices I was making, the money I was spending, the extra sleep I needed, exercise I was or wasn't getting, and even the sense that I could be making all of this up. And on top of all that, I wasn't talking with my loved ones about it with any regularity. Meeting Nate was a gift and a breakthrough because he modeled for me what kindness around my fibromyalgia should look like. Specifically, he pushed me to move from a place of isolation to regular sharing with him and with others about my pain and frustration. I did not want to share about my perceived weakness, but when I did, I felt such a palpable relief and calm, I couldn't deny that it was important. When I shared with Nate, he was kind and understanding. In short, he showed me compassion. Experiencing compassion can be an important first step to practicing self-compassion. But as we all know, it can be so difficult to turn a kind and gentle gaze onto ourselves and not shoot those second arrows. In addition to showing ourselves kindness and recognizing that we are not alone in our suffering, we must also take on the difficult task of recognizing our self-judgment, observing it neutrally, and creating some distance between us and that self-judgment. Over the past 17 years, my focus has shifted from seeking a definitive cure for fibromyalgia to finding a set of helpful tools to manage chronic pain. Moderate exercise, medication, supportive loved ones, and a mindfulness practice are critical and have helped me to see the pain as a pesky friend rather than a scourge that must be removed. Recently, after a number of years off from my fibromyalgia research, Nate and I have started looking again, and I'm walking down some new treatment avenues. I've let plenty of second arrows fly this time around, too, but I see them for what they are, and they aren't nearly as destructive this time around. I'm learning slowly to show kindness to myself, and I am a calmer, more joyful person because of it. Thank you.
Morning, I'm Michael Miller. I'm wondering how many of you, how many of you have shared your childhood with Ramona Quimby, or maybe your children's childhood or your grandchildren? She's the girl that Beverly Cleary introduced to the world in 1968 when she was entering kindergarten, 1 year after I had. Ramona Quimby was somebody who wanted to go out and experience life, and she was always interested in things. And she wanted to do things. For instance, when she saw a childhood with long curls, she just couldn't resist grabbing one and yelling, boing. When she saw a little Davy on the playground and decided to kiss him, she chased him around and around the playground in pursuit of this quest. When she wanted her mother to speed up a little, she threatened to throw a great big noisy fuss. When she was angry, she threw herself back on her bed and stamped her feet against the wall of her room. I could not stand her. She annoyed the heck out of me. Or rather, she would have, except that I wasn't supposed to use words like heck, so I didn't. I knew I was supposed to identify with Ramona, but I didn't. I mostly noted that, for one thing, her actions usually affected other people, and I tended to take the other people's side. I thought it was entirely reasonable that Susan should be able to attend school without wondering when somebody was going to sneak up behind her and boing her. And I thought that David should be the one to decide who would and would not kiss him. And that her older sister, Beezus, should not have to put up with marks that Ramona had stamped on the wall of their shared bedroom. More fundamentally, I wondered what kind of family Ramona belonged to. It wasn't that I didn't do the things that she did because I didn't want to. It hadn't really occurred to me that people did things like that. I felt a secret scorn for Ramona's mother, who allowed herself to be hurried up by threats of great big noisy fusses from her 5-year-old daughter. When Ramona angrily announced to her family, "I'm going to say a bad word," and her parents responded by saying, "Well, say the word if it will make you feel better," I gave up on them. It was clear to me that they did not understand their job. By the way, the word turned out to be guts. I didn't grow up in an Amish family, but my parents did. And a lot of those assumptions about how you raise children still applied. And one of the fundamental values that my parents and their peers held was that it's the job of parents to teach children things, and the fundamental one of those is self-control. It was taken for granted that children are capable of not yelling in the house and doing their share of chores and not hitting each other when they disagree and sharing and taking turns. We had it easier than our Amish peers. In summer, we got to wear lightweight short-sleeved shirts instead of long-sleeved ones, although we did not wear shorts, and that is one restriction that I've been glad to leave behind as an adult. We sat still in church, but it was on pews, not backless benches. And, you know, some of those lessons in sharing and turn-taking weren't just about parental philosophy. When you have 11 siblings and one bathroom, you've got to do it. I very seldom remember experiencing that kind of grappling as really as tight or suffocating or suppressive. I don't know how much some of my friends felt that way, and this has a lot to do with the personalities of me and of my four siblings. We are not naturally loud people. We tend in private moments to want to read instead of going outside and climbing trees and running around and yelling. My mother did us the enormous favor of filling our house with books, and my parents did not restrict our reading. So the one thing that they really could have hurt me on, we were fine to go with. And partly it fit my personality. I do remember as a child peeling chocolate frosting off a piece of cake and laying it to the side so that I could eat it last. And besides that, that emphasis on self-control made life better. I also lived in a community where most of my peers were conservative Mennonite and Amish, even at school. And so I have virtually no memories of hallway bullying, playground fighting. We showed up in time for class. The teachers had to spend very little energy on classroom management and getting people in line before they could actually teach. We even mostly cleared our plates in the lunchroom. It was a practiced skill to smuggle the last bits of things into an empty milk carton so you could dispose of it. To fully understand that, you would have to see what the lunchroom did to broccoli. And a lot of this is not stuff that I look back and want to repudiate. Learning self-control is one of the basic ways that we become mature humans. In fact, in many ways, it's the first things that our parents teach us. Long before they're teaching us to be nice or share, we're learning things like maintaining a feeding schedule and sleeping through the night and potty training. We're learning self-control. And we're at this odd place in our society now where we're having to take on sort of additional layers of self-control. People in the past have very seldom had problems with obesity because there wasn't enough food to grow fat on. We are facing the problem of having to discipline ourselves to eat in a healthy way in a society where we're constantly surrounded by abundance, which is why we're constantly writing new books about healthy eating patterns and trying to find other things that will work for us. So I remember my childhood mostly as being one in which I felt safe, and while there were plenty of times I would have liked to get by with more things, the restrictions my parents placed on us mostly felt to me fundamentally logical and fair. I also remember, though, living in that society that it was largely a closed system. You know, the people in my congregation were people who had grown up in the congregation or traditions like it, even at school, since many of my peers had the same assumptions. I remember fifth grade when one family moved into the community and for a year Tracy attended school with us. Tracy was exuberant. She was boisterous. She was loud. And I'm sure we were never consciously cruel to her or tried to exclude her, But I think we often weren't sure what to make of her. The family moved on after that year, and I've occasionally wondered since then if Tracy looks back on that year with that weird school where everybody looked at her like she was a freak. And, you know, that's not the congregation that Assembly wants to be. I'm not criticizing congregations that have that kind of high context, everybody belongs, everybody knows how this works kind of tradition, but it's not who we want to be. We've named ourselves as a congregation that's pursuing radical hospitality. And congregations and groups that practice lots of self-control can be much better at saying no than at saying yes, yes, yes. I haven't raised children, so I haven't had to make sort of daily decisions about how you teach children self-control. I've been interested in watching my peers do this and my siblings. I noted talking with my brother about my little nephew, for instance. His parents made very different decisions than ours had about emotional expression and how much noise you're able to make and how much you could express things like, I'm angry with you now. On the other hand, I remember the day that my brother, with a combination of sort of amusement and wonder, looked at his child and said, you know, people talk about wearing your feelings on your sleeve. My kid has his in a little cart that he pushes out in front of him. On the other hand, I also noticed that my brother and my siblings taught their children, you don't hit. In the same way that my parents had, there was no tolerance for fighting. There was an assumption that there are things you can control. And you will learn to do that when you are young. And then notice here at Assembly the many ways that we are teaching children self-control. We use a different vocabulary from the one I grew up with. In Children of Worship, we talk about being in a place where we talk differently, we walk differently. We talk about the fact that somebody else may be wanting to talk to God or listen to God, so we want to create space for it. We talk about quieting yourself so that somebody can release you to go to pick up your things. And the bottom line is we're teaching our children self-control because that's the way that we take care of ourselves, and it's the way we take care of each other. And as a congregation, I think we're really good at control. I would say we're a self-controlled congregation, certainly when we're compared with a Pentecostal congregation or a typical African-American large congregation. We worship in a controlled way. We have a plan. We stick to the plan. We don't even yell amen, which at least people I grew up with did. And I don't say we'd have to do more of that, but I think maybe we could bring back the amens so long as we make it clear that women are equally allowed to do that so we maintain our progressive values. Amen. Dave, you're a guy. I love this congregation. I love the way we do things, and it works really well for me. But I'm also aware that I am never going to be the first one to greet people when they walk in the door. I'm really much better at maintaining my own space than I am at opening up to other people. And I think one of the questions we'll be facing as we talk about being a radically welcoming congregation is, when do we maintain control, and when are we willing to let go of it just a little bit? I wonder what would happen if a middle-aged Ramona Quimby, after all, again, she is almost exactly my age, were to walk into this congregation this morning and had spent the morning worshiping with us. By the way, even if she married, I'm pretty sure she kept her name so that she could continue writing that Q as a little cat. I'm guessing that she would already have had two or three conversations with people here. I'm guessing that she would not be the person you talk to if you want to make sure that somebody's got the minutes of the meeting in perfect order and get those out in time. If you need a plan and make sure that there's someone to take care of the time. But I'm guessing she'd be one of the best idea people going. I'm guessing that she would have a lot of energy surrounding her as she come in. So for those of you who are really good at exuberance and idea people, thank you for being part of my congregation. I'll try to keep up. And as we're living into being a welcoming congregation, I'm looking forward to People who will ask us, you know, this or maybe this one or this, can you let go of control just a little bit? Maybe. We'll see.